Hello, my name is Claire and you are listening to the Hypnobirthing Podcast. Hello everybody and welcome back to another episode of the Hypnobirthing Podcast. I hope that everybody is doing well. I am here today with a really great, interesting episode from B, and B is from B's Birth and Boobs, and she's a hypnobirthing teacher and also a breastfeeding counsellor and kind of expert, I suppose I would say. She's here to talk about breastfeeding and bottle feeding, and we talk about things like best practices, safe bottle prep, what to expect during that first week. And it was really, really interesting. So if you are considering breastfeeding, then definitely give this a listen. Even if you're not and you're undecided, or if you're planning on bottle feeding, please do also give it a listen because it'll be really, really informative. I'll play it for you now. Hello, B. Thank you so much for joining me. If you would like to introduce yourself to everyone.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm B. I am a mum of two. I am from Leicestershire, Nottinghamshire area. I'm pretty much like smack bang in the middle of Leicester and Nottingham, but in the middle of absolutely nowhere. I'm a teacher and antenatal instructor and also a breastfeeding counsellor as well. Qualified a couple of years ago, and before that I was a breastfeeding peer supporter, but I also am an infant feeding support worker in the NHS as well. So I'm basically, my whole life is like vaginas and boobs. Pretty much I do nothing else apart from that.
That's so amazing. Yeah. But so needed as well, like the breastfeeding support part, you know, it is something that we lack, isn't it, in this country? So it is needed. Having
And it's so helpful. So I work in the community, so with like the health visitors rather than actually in the hospital. And I love that so much. I did do hospital for a short while and it just wasn't the place for me. I love community so much more, but I can see the need for it. It's the people that have just come out of the hospital and they're just kind of like, whoa, what's happened? I don't know what's going on. Can you help me? And a lot of it is, we just give so much information, and by the end of like a phone call, they're just kind of like, oh my gosh, wow, thank you. And just like, health visitors don't have the time for that. They just don't. So they've got so much other stuff to do. So we literally just solely do that infant feeding support. And we do bottle feeding support as well. Yeah. We don't just phone up and say, are you breastfeeding? No. Okay, bye. We do much support for bottle feeding as well, because I think people don't get that either. They just get told, oh, well, we're bottle feeding. They go, okay, great. See you later. Because they assume that, well, you just read the tin, and actually there is more to it as well.
Yeah, we're supposed to know, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I remember with my first, I actually ended up expressing for her exclusively for a year because she just never really latched, and like, we tried a lot. My mother-in-law used to be a midwife and a health visitor, and she's very like experienced in breastfeeding, and even she was like, I don't know why she's not latching. So I kind of started off by expressing, and then I had actually a midwife appointment like a few days after, you know, when they come around, and unluckily I had a midwife who, when I said what I was doing, when I said I was expressing, and that was kind of my plan, was just to carry on expressing, she sort of laughed a bit at me and sort of said, oh well, that won't last, kind of thing, like instead of being supportive,
like putting that doubt into you straight away, like, well, that's never gonna happen.
And also I was a first time mum, like literally three days after I'd given birth, like full of hormones. And
that's the worst, like, day as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the worst day. Like, rather than being like, oh wow, well done, that must be really hard, but well done, she kind of like told me that it was never gonna last. So I think she actually spurred something in me. And I was like, I'm gonna prove
wrong.
She's never gonna know. She's never gonna know whether I did it. But I will know. So I ended up, kind of just carrying on, because actually after the initial first few months where it's hardest, it actually then we got into a real routine, and I only then need to do express like a couple of times a day, you know, so that was fine. But with my second, she did latch fine. But it was kind of like my first time of breastfeeding, obviously, even though it was my second baby.
Pumping and bottle feeding, had to actually directly breastfeed. Two very different experiences.
And
I kind of found myself, yeah, like in first timer territory where I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. And my, again, my mother-in-law literally lives like 5 minutes up the road. And she came around, she was like, every time, like any time the baby needs feed, let me know, I'll come around and I'll help you. I mean, it wasn't quite every time, but like a lot of time, especially in the first few days. But honestly, without her help, I really would have struggled, because she really did help me, and she helped me to get my latch right. And, you know, that support, and people don't have that support. I mean, that was like one-on-one support whenever I needed it, really, which is amazing. Oh, and it was only because she's who she was, you know? So yeah, I understand how hard it is in those first few weeks, and how much that support makes such a big difference, because we're kind of just left to go off and do it on our own, aren't we? And people don't really know what they're doing, and we don't know whether the latch is right, or whether the pain that you're feeling is what you should be feeling, and things like that. So yeah, thank goodness for you and people like you that do the job that you do, because it is really needed. With the hypnobirthing, what kind of got you into wanting to teach that?
Yeah, so when I had my first, this was 6 years ago now, so it feels absolutely crazy that it's
oh my goodness,
ago.
Yeah.
But I did absolutely no preparation whatsoever. Right. I went into it just like, I would love a water birth, and it's going to work out.
Yeah.
It did not work out. It, on paper, it was a very, you know, fine birth. I had an episiotomy, but it was fine. I was in labor for like 48 hours before she was born, but it was fine. However, I came out of it feeling really, really overwhelmed. And I was just like, what's just happened? I felt very out of control.
Yeah.
And I think it definitely played a part in my postnatal depression following
it.
Just because I had no idea what to expect, absolutely no idea. So even before we even started to plan getting pregnant, so she was about two at the time, and I'd heard on another podcast about hypnobirthing, and I was like, I just started doing a bit of research into it, and then I found more podcasts and more Instagram accounts. Started following all these people, so that actually by the time that we did fall pregnant with my second, which was almost 2 years ago now, I was just like, right, things are going to be different. I've done loads and loads of reading. I've listened to loads of podcasts. I'm going to do hypnobirthing. We're going to have a home birth, and I'm going to hire a doula.
Yeah.
That was my plan. And the birth was incredibly healing. It didn't go exactly to plan. There were little things that I was like, oh, I would have hoped it would have been a bit different. But coming out of it, I felt so empowered. I felt so strong. And I just went, I want everyone to feel this way, regardless of the birth that they have. I want everyone to get that preparation, because the difference in my feelings after both experiences, like two pole opposites, but two very similar births.
Yeah. And like you said, it still didn't all go 100% to plan, but you felt so differently afterwards. Yeah. Also, I saw that your doula was Leanne, wasn't it, from Birthhood? Yeah, I saw that. She's been on here.
Yeah, to talk about, I that one as well.
Did you? Yeah. She's been on here. Yeah. I saw that the other day, and I was like, oh, that's so funny. What a coincidence. Yeah. How funny.
Amazing.
Yeah. Amazing.
Like, if we choose to have a third baby, I was like, I'm booking you like straight away.
Yeah.
That was something that my husband said has got to happen. I said,
wow.
Could we have a third? Because he's like, absolutely no way. So I've got a stepdaughter as well. So he was like, four children. And I said, well, maybe have another one. I don't feel done. And he was like, well, would we have Leanne there? And I said, well, obviously. He was like, well, okay, we'll have one. Leanne will be there. Because he was very sceptical about it.
Yeah.
And then literally as soon as the birth had happened, he was like, okay.
How amazing.
100%. He was messaging her that night afterwards going, I can't believe I was even a tiny bit sceptical. You are incredible. We need you so much. I needed you there, because it was support for him.
Yeah.
As well, so much.
It's
not just, she's not like taking over the role of the birth partner.
No.
She was working with him completely, and it was support all the way. So many times where he was probably getting a little bit anxious, a little bit worried about what was going on, he kind of like looked up at her.
She was fine.
So he was like, okay, I can calm down now. I can relax. Yeah. Absolutely fine.
Yeah. Oh, so, that's so good.
And I was like, right, I want to train. I want to do this for everybody. I want everyone to get this preparation. And I say to everyone, like, even if you don't book with me, just do something.
Yeah, that's what I always say.
I don't care if I don't get the money. I just want do something to prepare yourself, because it is so important, especially at the moment in the maternity, crisis. It is so needed. You can't just go into it and wing it and go with the flow and expect it just to kind of
No,
happen.
you really can't. You can't. It's unfortunately, you can't. That would be nice,
I
but
wish that our jobs weren't necessary.
yeah, I
They
know.
weren't
I
needed. I
know.
wish they weren't needed at all, but
I
they
know.
unfortunately are.
No, it's great. And it's great to have as many people doing that kind of thing, because then people have so much access to it, which is great, and which is what we need. Hypnobirthing is still, I mean, for us, because we do it all the time, it feels like it's everywhere, but it's really not. Like, so many people still are like, hypnobirthing, what? Whereas, yeah, for me, I feel like surely everybody knows hypnobirthing, but they don't. So there's definitely like, we need more people so that we can like grow a bit more in terms of what we're trying to do. But that's all good. You're helping people, which is great. So you're here today to talk about breastfeeding, and also we're going to talk about bottle feeding as well. So we're here generally just to talk about feeding, infant feeding, baby feeding. Okay, so I've got some questions that we're going to kind of chat through, and hopefully this will be really helpful for people. I actually haven't got an episode on feeding. I've talked about my own feeding experiences, but I'm not an expert, so it's helpful to have somebody on who actually knows what they're talking about. Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk to you about is proper infant feeding practices. So can you kind of talk through some of those?
So, in terms of bottle feeding or
Yeah,
breastfeeding?
I mean, maybe, yeah, maybe both. Yeah, maybe start with breastfeeding and then touch on bottle feeding.
I think when it comes to breastfeeding, it is very overwhelming in terms of what actually happens. And I think there are sort of a couple of things that I feel during pregnancy are really important to even know about, in terms of feeding and what feeding is actually like and the practices of it, because otherwise you go into it and it is kind of like, what's going on? And I have kind of like two, three top tips for that in terms of it. And the first one is to research that normal baby behavior and kind of in with that, how milk production actually works, because if you know that, it really does help. Because the baby behavior is very, it's not what we expect it to be, especially as a society. We expect that sort of 3 to 4 hourly feeds. They go in their cot afterwards, they sleep beautifully, and then they wake up, they have another feed, they go back to sleep. And that's just not realistic at all. And I think one of the main things that I speak to people about is that my baby won't settle apart from on me or on the breast. It must mean that I don't have enough milk. And it's just not the case at all. It's extremely normal behavior for them to do that. And I think knowing that is a really important part of actually being able to feed and feeling confident in it and have that practice of being able to do it, before you even go into how to latch a baby. That is a part of it and it's important. But before you even go into that, it's knowing that normal baby behavior, because them not settling in their cot is survival instinct. It's not them manipulating you. It's not them just wanting a cuddle. It's literally survival instinct. And it is the same, we talk about in hypnobirthing, how we talk about the fight or flight response. That's a survival instinct. It's just something that happens when we sense danger, even though it's not an actual real threat. It's not like an tiger that is appearing in our birth space. It's just this feeling like there's a threat going on and it halts birth, because it is that survival instinct. It's going, it's not safe. We need to protect us right now. It's exactly the same thing for a baby. When you put them in their cot, we know that it's safe. We can look at them and go, well, you're absolutely fine. I've made this beautiful cot for you and you're not settling in it, but you're fine. Look, it's safe. They don't know that. To them, you've completely abandoned them. They think that there's like a wolf coming to eat them, and they cry because they're like, if you leave me here, I'm going to die. I need you to pick me up.
Oh,
I know, it makes me upset.
it's really sad thinking about that, isn't it? But it's that's so true. Like they the only thing that they really know is you, isn't it? Until obviously they're born into the world. And then yeah, they're kind of in this big cot, or Moses' basket, or wherever they are, and you're not around. They maybe can't smell you or hear you. Yeah, it makes total sense.
And it means that it's completely normal for them to cry yeah. when you put them down.
And it's not that they're still hungry or anything like that. It's just that that is their normal instinct. Yeah.
And the thing is, they feed for so many reasons as well. You know, you yeah. get told constantly, oh, are they still hungry? You know, well, I don't know. They might still be hungry. They might be yeah. thirsty. They might just need to reconnect with me. They might need some help going to sleep. It may yeah. be that they're really overstimulated because there's loads of people come around and the baby's been passed around
yeah.
loads of people. And they're like, I just need you and my safe place.
Yeah.
There's so many reasons why they come to the breast. So it's recognizing yeah. that as well. So even if they are coming back very frequently, yeah. it's saying actually, it might not necessarily mean that they are hungry, but they are coming for a reason, and it could be one of a thousand reasons.
Yeah.
And that's really normal behavior as well. And I think it can be very difficult to get out of that societal expectation of this is what's meant to happen with feeding. I think because of the generations, it's kind
yeah.
of slowly coming out of it now, but yeah. it's still really difficult because
I was going to say the generation thing is like quite common, isn't it? When you've got your kind of parents or in-laws or yeah. whoever kind of saying, oh, you know, I used to put oats in the bottle or whatever rubbish God, they yeah. tell you.
Oh God.
No. I mean, that might be a bit further down the line than newborn, but yeah, like I remember like those kind of comments and yeah. it's such a generational thing.
Yeah.
Whereas we know so much more now, don't we? Which is good.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Because I had someone from the health visiting team the other week. We were talking about normal feeding behavior. And she went, oh gosh, when mine were newborn, and this was only about 30 years ago. So when I was born, she went, yeah. when they were born, we were told to feed them like at 10, 2, 6, and 10, and then that was it.
Oh wow.
The whole day from newborn. I was like, oh my goodness. It's like, that's definitely not what you do now.
So what was happening if they were crying because they were hungry? I guess they just ignored them.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
It was that sort of time.
But yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. And then my milk supply just yeah. went at 6 yeah. weeks. I'm like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
That's quite yeah. That's not surprising that it disappeared because we weren't doing that responsive feeding. So the milk supply wasn't getting that demand. And that's the yeah. another important thing is knowing how that milk supply works, knowing that a baby is coming to the breast, not because they're starving, but because they're actually building your milk supply ready.
Yeah.
So it doesn't yeah. mean, oh my goodness, they are starving. They're coming back every 5 minutes. They do that cluster feeding, lots and lots of feeds on the breast or, you know, coming to it really frequently because they're building that ready for them for yeah. another time. So it's not that they need it right now and they're hungry, it's that they know in a few days time. They're so clever, honestly,
so clever.
It blows my mind every time that they know
so clever.
They're about to go through a growth spurt and they're
yeah.
going to need more milk. So we build that supply by
yeah.
feeding really frequently, so knowing that that normal baby behavior alongside how that milk production actually works is just so vital. Because if you know those things, you've got
yeah
big confidence there in knowing that actually this is normal.
Yeah.
This is completely normal. What's happening is absolutely fine. It's healthy. They are building my milk supply. I'm their safe place. And they're just a
Yeah.
baby. And
Yeah.
in our hypnobirthing classes towards the end, we do like a section on the postpartum period. And we do like, what does the baby feel like? And what are they experiencing in the womb? And
Yeah.
what are they going to experience when they come out to the world? And we write down, you know, it's dark, it's cozy,
Yeah.
they're naked, it's wet.
Yeah. They're never hungry.
Never hungry. And then we do
Yeah.
the opposite onto the world and like, okay, so they're clothed, they're dry, it's
Yeah.
light, there's lots of loud
Noisy.
Music. Like, oh my gosh. And it kind of is a bit of a light bulb moment. They go,
Yeah.
wow, it is literally the complete opposite. It is
Yeah.
no wonder these babies actually do struggle to adapt and they are just sitting at the breast. Or
Yeah.
because they need it. They
Yeah.
absolutely need it. And then
It's comforting.
Yeah. And then knowing that how you can tell that a baby is getting enough milk is like my next sort of top tip. If you know
Yeah.
that feeding behavior is completely normal and how that milk production works, if you then know how to tell if a baby is getting enough milk is then really, really helpful. Because even if you know that that feeding behavior is normal, it's really common to still have those moments of, oh my God, they are feeding it for ages. They're feeding so frequently. Maybe they aren't getting enough. Maybe I do need to do a top up. Whereas if you know the signs of if a baby is getting enough milk, then you can then reassure
Yeah.
yourself, okay, everything is absolutely fine and dandy.
Yeah. What are the signs?
So the best one, I think, to be able to easily tell is by nappy output. It's very simple. It's very easy for parents to be able to recognise it themselves, because all you literally need to do is count nappies. So it's really quick and easy. So in the first week, it's a little bit different compared to after that. So during the first week, it's very easy to say one wet nappy per every day old the baby is. So if it's day one, one wet nappy, two wet nappies, nice and easy to be.
That's able. Easy, yeah.
And then up to about sort of day five, six, it tends to stay at five, six wet nappies. Nice and sort of quite heavy nappies, not just like a little dribble. You know, we wouldn't count tiny little dribble. It can be quite difficult sometimes in the first couple of days to figure out if they have done a wee or not, because it tends to mix in with the poo and you just go, is it not? So I sometimes suggest popping some like cotton wool into the nappy, because then that soaks it up and you go very clearly when you next change a nappy that, oh yes, there definitely is wee there. That's good. That's
yeah,
a good
that's sign. A good idea.
So the wet nappies are a really good sign. But then dirty nappies are really, really important as well. So we want about one to two dirty nappies right up until about 6 weeks, when your supply starts to settle. And that's when they might start having like a few days or so without having a poo and it can be normal. Up until then, if they do go a day or two without having a poo, it's a good idea to get some support and investigate. It doesn't necessarily mean that there is something really, really wrong, but it's a good idea to check it out, because they can look at full picture, they can see how feeding is actually going, check latch and stuff. But it's a good idea to get that skilled support rather than just kind of ignoring it and going, oh well, it's fine, because it is sometimes a red flag. But what's important in that first week is actually the color change of the poo. And we're talking about poo a lot, but honestly, my parents, we talk about poo so much. That's a topic of conversation.
It is.
But right on day sort of one, two, the poo will be that thick meconium, really sticky, really horrible one to clean. And this is the one I say for like birth partners, other parents, other support people. Because if you are breastfeeding, you should not be cleaning that first nappy.
It's like tar, isn't it?
It literally is. It's kind of like trying to clean off like Marmite off a baby's bum.
Marmite is a great comparison,
It literally is. So yeah, it's very sticky. But that's a normal first poo, absolutely good. Across onto sort of like day two, three, that colour will change to us like a green khaki colour. And that can look a bit strange. You can be like, why are they having green poos?
I remember that.
And the colour, it's like changes a little bit browny as well, and it is a lot more looser in consistency. It's not kind of that sticky. It does get a little bit easier to clean off at this point, you'll be pleased to know. And then after that is when it changes to a sort of like browny color, then a yellow color, and by the end of that first week the color should be a mustard yellow. It should be very, very loose. A lot of people actually worry that it almost looks like diarrhea by the end, because it is so watery.
Yeah, they're not like hard, are they?
Not at all. They are literally like pure water sometimes.
And they've got the little seedy bits in, don't they?
Yeah, and it worries some people. They go, it looks like there's seeds in there. I'm like, it's not seeds, don't worry. It's not actually seeds. It's basically bits of like fat of the breast milk that just hasn't sort of broken down fully. But it is quite normal to get those little seedy bits. And it kind
and
of...
And also, I remember they don't smell, like they don't, the poos don't start smelling bad until they eat actual like food. I remember that bit. Like, it's not a bad smell, is it? It's just like
they don't smell horrible at all.
No, they don't.
I kind of don't know if I should be admitting this on a podcast, but I sometimes found it quite a comforting smell.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I minded it. It's quite a sweet smell, I think, as well. Yeah. Like, I don't think I ever minded it. It is a shock when they start eating proper food and then they do really stink.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, obviously.
I straight away went, as soon as he started eating food this time, I went, oh no.
Yeah.
You've got nice breast milky poos anymore.
Yeah. They're like very, they're very easy, aren't they? And not really very offensive. I do remember that. Apart from if they do like kind of go everywhere, which
An
happens sometimes.
One, all up the bat. That's always a fun one to clean.
Oh yeah. We've all had one of them, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. And you kind of go, do I just throw out the vest? Or do I attempt to clean it?
Yeah. Oh, I remember one with my eldest, she was like on the changing mat on the like dresser, and then I was kind of taking it off, but as I did it, she like went and it flew across the room onto like the wardrobe. And you know when you're standing there, I'm like, I do not know what to tackle first.
No, it was like
all over her, all over me, all over the walls. Like, I don't know what to do first.
Oh,
I
mean,
I think I put her in the bath. I think that was kind of my answer, was just like, put her in the bath first.
Yeah.
Very messy, yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, dear. But yeah, that kind of change in the poo is a really good indicator that they're getting that milk. They're flushing out the meconium out of their system. If you're maybe on, you know, day four and you're still having those black meconium poos, that's maybe, again, an indicator to get some skilled support, because maybe they aren't getting the milk that they need to flush that meconium out. So it's really important, not just the amount of the dirty nappies, but that colour and consistency as well. You want that transition throughout that last week, so that it is that good indicator of milk intake. And once it goes on to those yellow poos, that is a good sign that your mature milk is coming through as well. And I say mature milk coming through rather than milk coming in, because sometimes if you say milk coming in to people, they go, well, what happens then until the milk comes in? There's nothing
right
there. So I like to say that it goes from colostrum to mature milk instead.
Yeah.
So it kind of reassures people that there is milk, or like what you typically would sort of imagine as milk, that sort of white color of milk.
I think it's really hard, isn't it? Like, that's one of the hardest things, I think, is because you can't see how much they're drinking and whether they are actually getting anything. It's really the most difficult part, I think, is judging, have they fed enough? And it is hard. And that's some good advice on things to go by, because, I've heard so many people say, like, oh, I wasn't sure they were getting enough, so I, started topping them up. And that, I guess, is when your supply then starts to kind of drop. Which can cause problems.
That sort of pop-up trap that goes through not making enough. So you give them a bit extra, and then they don't come to the breast as often. So your supply does then drop. And then so you top up again because you feel like not getting enough. And it is literally
that. It's a cycle,
right from the beginning. But I really do firmly believe, because I feel like this is something that I come across so often. This is the most frequent worry, I think, in parents, that they go, my baby isn't getting enough milk, so I am topping up. And I kind of dig in a bit deeper. Why is that? Why do you feel they're not getting enough? Well, because they're not settling. They're just going to sleep. They're not going that 3-4 hours between feeds. And I think if people were aware of what to expect beforehand, that they will feed frequently because of your supply, because it's survival instinct, and then having that reassurance of, well, how do I know that they're getting enough milk? I just think it would help so, so many people, because it is a massive common concern in parents. If they kind of know, I tell them to like keep a bit of like a tally chart of how many wet nappies and how many dirty nappies. So if it gets to, 8 p.m. and the baby's cluster feeding and they start going, oh my God, I must not have milk, I must be starving them, you can look back at that tally chart and go, well, it's day four, they've had 5 wet nappies so far, 3 dirty nappies. The colour of it was kind of nearing towards a yellow colour. So that's a good sign. That means that they are getting, and it just reassures yourself that I am doing enough, they are getting enough milk. And it's okay. It's not a bad thing. It's not a worry.
Yeah.
We all get that. You know, even second time around for me, when I was a qualified breastfeeding counsellor and I was an infant feeding in the NHS, I still had moments of, are they getting enough? Is it something
it's
that I'm
normal,
doing wrong?
Yeah.
I had to reassure myself of that as well. So it is completely normal, regardless of who you are and your background, that to get that little bit of doubt. So it's only natural that the people that aren't trained in that area
and first timers
so much more worry and concern. I certainly did first time. I was messaging my mum constantly because she breastfed me and my 3 sisters. She was very familiar with it, and I remember messaging her on like day 3 when she did start cluster feeding loads, and I was like, she's coming on the breast for like 5 minutes and then having 5 minutes off and then having 5 minutes on again and then 5 minutes off, what's going on? She went, B, that's cluster feeding. That's really normal. It's building your milk supply. I was like, oh, yeah, you were there.
Cluster feeding, that is like, I remember that being very hard.
Yeah, and I think it's very overwhelming. Even if you know to expect it, it can sort of still take you by surprise, and you're literally just kind of like glued to the sofa or glued.
And it's usually like in the evening, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, because your milk making hormone is higher in the evening at night. So babies want to sort of build that milk supply even more. So it's 30% higher between like 12 and 4 a.m.
Wow.
So not the hours that we want it to be.
Damn it.
I'm like, it's the worst time, but it is doing a good thing. And sometimes it's that, you know, I know it's difficult, I know it's hard, but it is for a good reason. Like they're doing it. There's a reason behind it. It's not just a random time that they've picked out to make you really tired. It's for a very clear biological reason.
And it's temporary as well. I think that, yeah, you definitely kind of think, oh my goodness, I can't do this for the next 6 months or however long. But it is just temporary. They don't do that forever.
And you do feel like that's it. When you're in that moment of they are feeding constantly, they are always on you, you go, okay, this is my life now.
Yeah.
And it's not. And I love my favorite phrase is this too shall pass.
Yeah.
Every little thing is a phase. Yeah. Absolutely everything. It will get better. You will get out the other side of it, even though it doesn't feel like it at the moment. It
does
get better and it does improve.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, so what are some of the benefits of breastfeeding then?
Yeah, I love this one because I think we're constantly told, you know, I hate the phrase breast is best. That is not something that I go by.
Yeah.
But I feel like it is a constant thing that is people talk about, you know, breastfeeding's the best. There's so many benefits to it. But actually, no one knows the benefits to it. No one's actually told when you're being told during pregnancy.
Yeah, why?
It's really good for the baby. Why is it? You're not told that at all. So one of it is that there is less hospitalization for things like diarrhea and vomiting and respiratory sort of problems. So things like asthma and stuff for babies and as they get older children as well, because it's building that immune system to that. So there is, you know, benefits to that as well. One of the big ones, which I think can worry some people, but for some it's really helpful, is that it reduces the risk of sudden infant death syndrome by about 50%.
Wow.
It's a really, really big amount. They're not quite entirely sure why that is. There has been research around it, but they're not actually sure of the reasons for it. There's theories around the fact that it's because the babies wake a little bit more frequently, because that deep sleep that sometimes bottle-fed babies go into is, you know, they go into that deep sleep and it puts them at greater risk of SIDS, whereas breastfed babies, they are feeding very frequently. It is that, again, it's that keeping them alive, survival instinct of them feeding frequently. Again, that's something that I kind of say to people in terms of, oh, my baby's, you know, waking 2-3 hours at night, they're not sleeping through. I'm like, yeah, it's hard. However, it's probably them protecting themselves.
Yeah.
Again, so it's a good thing. Sometimes that kind of gives it a little bit of a, well, it's for a good reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it can obviously be very worrying for the people that maybe couldn't breastfeed, that is my baby at higher risk of sudden infant death syndrome. Obviously, we have very, very small numbers of SIDS to reassure anyone that is bottle feeding or is planning to. It's not, you know, big, big numbers, even though it is a higher chance, it's still
tiny,
extremely minute. It is a very, very low chance that your baby is going to die from SIDS. It's so, so, so low. So please don't feel worried if you are bottle feeding or you're planning to formula feed in any way, because it's not, you're not increasing your chances absolutely massively. It is still a very small percent. Breastfeeding reduces the risk of childhood cancers as well. So that can be something that some people are really, really keen to do, especially if maybe they have experience with family or something with cancer. A very common one is it reduces the chances of ear infections. So it tends to be quite a common thing with children that they get infections literally constantly. They're always blooming poorly.
So they are.
It reduces quite a lot. Diabetes, it reduces the chance of type 1 diabetes, asthma. It helps to as well protect the gut microbiome. So this is something that fascinates me, and I've still not quite got my head around the microbiome. It still kind of like blows my mind when I think about it, but it's amazing. It literally heals the gut. It provides it with so much immunity and antibodies, and it's just incredible. And there is some recent research around, so like obviously with C-sections, they don't get that initial gut microbiome because they're not coming through the birth canal.
Yeah.
And having basically the poo in their mouth.
Yeah.
But there's research around that if you exclusively breastfeed, by 3 months, it's the same level as a baby that's had a vaginal birth. So if you are having a C-section and you're really worried about something like the gut microbiome, you can, you know, if you want to breastfeed, that's like going to be exactly the same level by the time 3 months, which I think is absolutely incredible that breastfeeding can do that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's very recent research. That's only come out quite recently.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then for the breastfeeding parent, so maternal benefits as well, because we focus on the baby benefits.
We do.
There are benefits for you as a breastfeeding parent as well.
Yeah.
So mental health is one of them. And that's for a couple of reasons, because you are getting that oxytocin boost when the baby comes for a feed, and you're getting that skin to skin contact. You're sort of with your baby a little bit more. So it helps with the mental health. However, it can go in the complete opposite direction if you are maybe not getting support, or your family doesn't understand feeding and you're getting sort of like pressures around you. It can go in the total other direction, and you can get poor mental health if, you know, you're not getting that right support. So that is why, again, support is so key.
Yeah.
Because if you get that, you're going to get better mental health. So it is protected for like post-age depression and stuff like that. Cardiovascular disease as well. It reduces your chances of getting breast cancer and ovarian cancer. So and that actually increases, well, reduces, it reduces even further for the longer that you breastfeed. So if you continue feeding for like a year, 2 years, 3 years, it's going to reduce even more. So, you know, you tend to get those comments if you like carry on over a year. Oh, you're doing it. Yes, I am doing it for me because I want to reduce my chances of cancer. So you can absolutely say that if you want. Yeah. Like, yes, I'm doing it for me. No problem at all with saying that. It's obviously, it's difficult. Sometimes people say a benefit is money. But that, again, it can go in two ways, because obviously you're not having to buy the formula, buy the bottles. But what if you want to pump? What if you want to buy breastfeeding clothes? All these other things that come along with it. So I don't like to say that saving money is a particular thing, because that's very different compared to each family and kind of what matters to them.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are absolutely tons.
That's amazing, because like some of them I didn't know. And like I kind of technically breastfed my first. I do quite like to say I breastfed her because it was my milk, but not actually. And then I breastfed my second for like 2.5 years.
Yeah.
So I'm pleased about those last statistics that you gave. some of those I didn't know. And actually, also the other thing I wanted to say when you were talking about it was the oxytocin boost that you get when you feed. I used to feel it. I used to be very aware of the oxytocin that like was coming out when I was feeding. Like, it made me feel just really
you feel very
content
calm and, relaxed,
and
don't
yeah,
you?
Calm and happy. And it's fun. And I, because of like the hypnobirthing and everything like that, I was very aware of that's what it was and that's how it makes you feel. So I knew that that's how I was feeling. But it's so funny because it definitely happens. Like, it definitely happened for me that I used to feel like, you know, as soon as she latched, and I was like, it was a nice feeling. But that's, you know, breast milk's fascinating because it just changes, doesn't it, as well, for like what the baby needs. And if the baby's poorly, it will change, won't it? And obviously you have the whole, like, I used to put breast milk on everything, which is what people do.
Everything. Literally.
So like,
people say, oh, they've got gunky, I'll put some breast milk in it.
Squirt it in the eye, or like on cuts and things like that. And I had some like in the freezer for ages after I stopped, and I'd kind of defrost a little bit of it and rub it on if anyone needed it. It's amazing. And I did notice that it did help those things as well. So like, you know,
I used
a cut
it
or something.
For conjunctivitis.
Did you? Yeah.
At one point. So I was using boiled water and salt, and it just wasn't doing a thing. And I just went, do you know what? I'm gonna use some of my breast
Why
milk.
Not? Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah.
It got rid of it like instantly. I'd been using salt water for days and it wasn't doing a thing. Used breast
How
milk like twice
amazing.
And it was gone.
Like, yeah.
Incredible. It kind
it
of
honestly
confirmed how magic it actually is.
I remember my I think my husband had something once, maybe like a cut or something, and I think I was like, Do you want me to get some breast milk on it? His face. No, you're all right, thanks. That was maybe a step too far for him.
Oh no.
But no, yeah, it is amazing. Breast milk is like, yeah, just in, you know, in itself, what it, yeah, does, the fact that it changes. And I'm sure everyone, or if they haven't, they can Google those images of like the breast milk for the ill baby and then the breast milk, how it looks normally. Yeah. And they're a completely different color, aren't they? Because it's got so much different stuff in it. Yeah.
And during it's amazing. COVID, we actually found that breast milk was killing COVID cells.
How amazing.
And women with COVID weren't getting it. They weren't struggling with it. They were able to just,
wow,
fight it off. So it was, yeah, yeah, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. So what are, I mean, we have touched on this slightly, I guess, with our first question, but what are some of the common challenges? So there are a few we've touched on, but are there any others?
Yeah, I think the main one is painful feeding.
Mm.
And about 35% of people stop breastfeeding before they want to due to pain. And I'm probably going to upset a lot of people here by saying that breastfeeding should not be painful.
No.
It should be. And by that, I don't mean that a tiny bit of discomfort at the beginning, that can be really normal. You know, the first initial latch, I don't know about you, but during pregnancy, my nipples were so sensitive that even,
yeah,
bar on them hurt.
Yeah. And so you don't, you've got a baby like sucking, yeah, on your nipple for however, yeah, many hours a day. It's just,
they
not have a normal practice.
They have a very strong suck.
They do. And they're not, you know, I guess for most people, your nipples aren't used to that kind of attention all day.
Yeah.
So it, of course, like it's, yeah, you know, they're going to get a little bit tender at first, yeah, because of that constant attention on them.
Absolutely. And that's exactly it. You know, it's normal for the first sort of minute, mm, or so to sort of be like, oh, what's that? Ouch. Hang on.
Yeah.
What's going on? And it's a strange sensation. Rather than it being a pain, I say that,
yeah,
it's more a sensation than a pain. But if you are experiencing excruciating pain throughout the whole feed, like sandpaper on your nipples, and you have cracked, bleeding nipples, and you know they're really, really sore in between, that's not a good sign. You know,
yeah,
that's not normal. It's common, but not normal. And it should,
yeah,
you shouldn't just sit there and suffer. And I feel like because there is this common theme that breastfeeding is really painful, you just got to push through it for the first couple of weeks, that people,
yeah,
just sit and try and push through that soreness, that bleeding nipples, because they're told that, yeah, it's completely normal. So they just sit and suffer through it. And then obviously they get to the point where they go, oh my gosh, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to stop. And it's no surprise. I absolutely,
yeah,
would if my nipples were cracked and bleeding as well.
Yeah.
But it's not normal. You should absolutely seek support. It means that there is something going on with the latch. So that,
Yeah.
latch is really important. Like we said earlier, that is, it is an important thing of feeding, to get a deep attachment. You don't sort of just put the baby to the nipple on the boob and that's
Which
it.
Is what it always looks like in films and things like that, doesn't it? That,
yeah,
the baby just literally like
that's
has the nipple in their mouth. But
yeah,
it is deep. It's much deeper than that. They need much more of it into their whole mouth, don't they?
Yeah. And that's exactly it. If the latch is shallow, it means that the nipple is being squashed between the hard palate of their mouth. So it's literally pinching constantly. And with this as well, they're probably not going to be able to get as much milk either, because they need to get a deep latch to be able to almost massage the breast properly to
Right,
get
yeah.
the milk drawn out. If you were to try and hand express and go right to the end of the nipple,
That's so true.
Whereas if you go backwards,
Yeah.
get much more milk out, and it's
That's
a
a
lot.
good point.
So it is really important to get that attachment. And I'd say if you are experiencing any pain that is like lasting more than 60 seconds at the beginning of the feed, and you do maybe have the start of cracked nipples, get some support,
Yeah.
because it really shouldn't be
Yeah.
at that point of being painful. You should absolutely be able to experience comfortable feeding. I'm not going to say completely pain-free, because it might not be for the first part.
It's just that initial kind of latching, isn't it? I remember I used to, because I'd seen it somewhere, but I used to suck on a drink like,
yeah,
as she was first latching, which
Oh, I
helped.
heard
Yeah, I helped with that initial kind of first, yeah, 60 seconds of like,
oh,
of discomfort,
yeah,
just kind of sucking on a straw, you know, that had, you know, in a drink.
Yeah.
which, yeah, I as far as I can remember, it was a while ago now, but as far as I can remember, I think it worked.
Oh,
or
no.
helped
Oh.
it helped yeah maybe yeah pass that one on but it helped
Yeah.
But I mean, I suffered definitely from cracks and, or,
Yeah.
you know, I definitely remember there being some sort of exposed bits on my nipples that were really sore. And again, it was just, I think it was just like latch issues,
yeah,
of just trying to get that latch right. And then as soon as it was, like, yeah, I breastfed her for 2.5 years. Like, it was the easiest thing in the world once we'd got past that initial part. Yeah, which was difficult. Yeah, it was difficult, and it is hard.
Yeah. And it tends to take like a while to get into it. It's not just an immediate thing that it's just going to happen at birth and then that's it. It is like a bit of it's a skill to learn.
And they're learning,
the baby. It's you learning together. I kind of sometimes compare it to a baby learning how to walk. You know, they get up, take maybe a step or two, and then they fall back down. And then they get up and take another couple of steps and fall back down.
Yeah.
It's very similar. You're learning. So some feeds are going to go better than others as well at the beginning. Some feeds are going to go, yeah, that's brilliant. That was a perfect latch. I'm really happy with that. And then the next feed, you might really, really struggle. And actually, that one's a bit more sore. And you go, I don't know what I was doing there. I'm not quite sure what happened. And that's okay, because you're learning. No one's expecting you to kind of, they say, you know, when you give birth in the hospital, like, oh, we want you to go home confident feeding. No one's ever going to be confident leaving after that amount of time, because it takes weeks for that process. So it is normal for you to experience.
If you are on like a second or subsequent baby, is the kind of discomfort less, because I guess your nipples kind of a bit more robust if you've done it before, if you see what I mean? If you've breastfed before, are they a little bit like rougher, you know, a bit harder, so they're not quite so sensitive to it? Or is it the same?
It was the same.
Oh, really?
It was still that initial discomfort for a few, you know, 10, 20 seconds at the beginning, a little bit of a pinch, certainly, but it didn't last longer than that. Because I had like the training this time, I was very much aware of making sure I had that really good latch, really deep attachment, and I was adjusting it if it didn't feel deep enough. And I think for the first sort of couple of days, like day one and two, I find that even if you do have that shallow latch, it doesn't hurt as much. It tends to kick in about day three or four. And that's when, if you haven't had that deep attachment before and you're just carrying on, that's when it suddenly gets really, really bad. And you go, oh my God, that's definitely what happened to me second time. I really remember it. We were kind of not really focusing on the latch all that much. I was just kind of going with it, trying to do what I was very tired. And then suddenly it just became a little bit more.
Is that because the milk is then there? And I guess your boobs in general are probably fuller and a bit harder, aren't they? So it's kind of harder to get that latch as well.
I think that sensitivity definitely increases around that sort of time. But that's something that I find really common as well, that, you know, you get that first couple of days and everything's fine, and then suddenly it just becomes really, really painful and nothing's changed. As well, also, it's very important that people are aware of tongue ties, and that is something that is definitely becoming more aware of. But that can impact, you know, the latch and the comfort of the latch. So if it is painful and everything from the outside looks like, yeah, that's a good latch, I don't know what the problem is, it may be that there's something going on inside the baby's mouth rather than what you're doing. But a lot of health professionals are not qualified, they're not trained to actually check it. Even if they say, oh, we'll check for tongue tie, it's very rare that someone is qualified. So it is making sure that if they are doing it, it's asking, do you have the qualifications? Do you have the training to do a full check? And a check is not them looking in the mouth.
Right.
So often it is not just peek in the mouth and going, no, there's no tongue tie. It's got to be, they should have a glove on their hand. They should be putting fingers into the baby's mouth. And it's like a 5-point checklist that they are checking the function of the tongue. So it should not just be, oh no, I've looked and I don't think there's a tongue tie there. It needs to be a full-on check. And it's either finding like the infant feeding team in your area and asking if they can do the check, because they will be qualified,
Yeah.
or even going privately, maybe if
Yeah.
that's an option, because yeah, it's not something that happens often that someone is actually trained in it, but it's maybe
Yeah.
find someone that is trained to check it if
Right.
you are still experiencing pain and it's not going away with changing of the latch.
Okay. Are there any other kind of challenges that we've not touched on? There's
Yeah.
loads.
I mean, supply problems, like we've said at the very beginning, you know, people doubting their supply is a massive, massive one. A lot of people stop breastfeeding before they want to because of doubting their supply. But we've gone over, you know, how to sort of know if your
Yeah.
supply is enough anyway. Things like mastitis is quite a common one.
Yes.
And it is really important with mastitis to keep feeding through it. It used to be,
Yeah.
they used to say, oh, stop feeding. You can't feed with this infection. But it's really
Yeah.
important to feed through it. And now there's new guidance that instead of using heat and massage, we use cold to reduce the
Oh.
inflammation, and lymphatic breast massage instead. So instead of you're trying to massage towards the nipple, you're actually massaging towards the chest wall instead.
Okay.
So there's some more sort of studies and research about it. So yeah, if you do experience mastitis, it doesn't always need antibiotics. It's only if you really do start to get sort of those flu-like symptoms and stuff,
Yeah.
you need to seek support and actually get that antibiotics. But yeah, it can be quite a common thing, mastitis. But ways that you can help to reduce it a little bit, feeding, following baby's cues, trying to not breasts become too engorged and stuff, because that builds up the breast even more.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's another one as well.
Yeah.
Thrush. Although thrush is commonly diagnosed, but it's not actually a lot of the time thrush. It's normally something else going on. It might be like a latch problem or something like that. But
Oh,
it's very
wow.
commonly diagnosed just with the milk on the tongue or pain in the nipples. But what should happen is a swab taken for you and the baby to actually diagnose it properly. That's really, really important to actually get that proper diagnosis rather than just giving antibiotics and stuff, because
Right.
if it isn't thrush, you need to fix the problem.
Yeah.
You know, if it is painful.
Yeah.
A very common one as well is oversupply. And that
Yes.
tends to happen by, it's very rare that it just happens naturally, but a lot of the time it happens because we are additionally pumping on top of breastfeeding. So
Yeah.
one of the biggest things that causes it that I know of is the hacker pump. Love the hacker pump. So I'm probably going to get loads of hate for saying that. But because it suctions onto the breast, people
Yeah.
are using it in the early weeks while they're getting loads and loads of leakage, because they're like, I don't
Yeah.
want to waste it. And yeah, you don't want to waste it. Of course you don't. But you suction it on, which actually stimulates the breast more. You tend to attach it almost every time that you feed as well, because you're like, well, I might as well. I'll get
You want
all.
to catch it, yeah.
And then you're actually stimulating the breast more. So you're creating an oversupply, and then suddenly you've just got your breasts filling up constantly, and you've got to
Yeah.
try and reduce it. You can still use the hacker if you want to catch it, but instead of suctioning it on, literally just place it
I'll just hold it,
under the
yeah.
breast. So you're not doing that stimulation. You can literally just catch it.
I used to just hold a bottle sometimes underneath the other one to catch the letdown, because it does feel like such wasted milk.
Oh,
You're like,
isn't it?
oh, I don't want to waste it. I want to catch it all. But actually, I think I suffered from oversupply with my second. And it wasn't because I definitely, like, I wasn't expressing or anything with her after doing it for a year. I was like, I'm
Oh,
not
God, no.
expressing.
I'm not
But I
going near.
think, yeah, no, do not show me a pump. But I think where, I mean, I don't know this, I'm just guessing this is what it might have been. Where I'd pumped so much previously, I feel like my body, like, maybe responded differently to the feeding, because I only, like, as I said, I didn't express for her. I just fed her and, you know, just fed her kind of normally. But I had, I think, a huge oversupply pretty much for the first, well, definitely 6 months, because my letdown was always crazy. Like it would spurt
Spray
everywhere,
everywhere.
everywhere. And she was like, I had to take her off of me when it was doing that because I was worried she was like choking on it because there was so much milk. But also at night, it was just the, I had to put breast pads, basically didn't do anything. They did not catch all of the milk that was coming out. So I used to cut a nappy in half and put a nappy.
More absorbent. Like,
because they're so absorbent. So I used to sleep with them in nappies stuck down my top. But also the nappies, when they get really wet, they let out those little crystally things that are in them. So I used to wake up with, because they'd just be absolutely soaked. And my top would be like, it was very quite, it was very messy. And obviously breast milk is quite sticky. So you'd kind of wake up with all of this, like your clothes would be stuck to you. But I did
the shower.
I definitely think I did suffer from it, which it was a bit of a pain, but I was quite pleased that I had so much milk, but it was it was a pain because it was just very messy all the time.
Yeah, it can be a bit inconvenient to have an oversupply. It's almost like, because it can then increase the risk of mastitis as well.
Yeah, and I did, I didn't get full-blown mastitis, but I did get like blocked the block ducts quite often, so.
So it can be sort of almost as annoying and as difficult as a low supply, because they just leak everywhere.
Oh,
I'm
so annoying.
Still having to wear breast pads during the day and during the night, and he's won this Sunday. It's like, oh my goodness. Up until about sort of 4-5 months, I was having to change my breast pads multiple times a day because it just wasn't doing it.
And they don't catch a lot, do they, really? They're quite like little. And I was using the, I use both. I use the disposable ones, but then I also use the reusable ones because I was going through so many. But they never really caught kind of enough of it, which is why I turned to nappies, which was just the most awful thing ever, going to sleep with nappies.
Gotta do
down
what
top.
You've got
but
to do.
You've got to do what you're going to do. Yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah, there's a lot of sort of like common challenges. And then there are kind of other things that can crop up that are definitely less common. Obviously tongue tie is definitely a common one as well, but it can be very difficult to get that diagnosis of that. But once you get that support, you know, checking in with someone, even just asking a question, so finding, you know, your local peer support group and just asking them a question, oh, I've got this, or this is happening, can you make any suggestions, is this normal, what's going on, rather than just kind of like sitting there and suffering by yourself. There is, you know, even though there are these challenges, they can be overcome, and usually quite easily, as long as you have good support around you, as long as you have that, the right information to be able to manage it.
And the support, like, it's not, it is there, like, it might not be like really readily accessible as we need it, but it is there. You just might have to seek it out. Like, there are, like you said, so many breastfeeding support groups around that. I mean, I know we've got one locally to us that meet up every week, and you know, it's so helpful, it must be so helpful for people. So it is there, you just might need to kind of have a little look
for it a little bit. I love our local support group. People come sort of every week on
a
normal basis, like if they've not even got any problems, because it's to have that conversation with other people that are through similar things. And you don't just have to come if, you know, you're having painful feeding or need help with the latch. People come just for a chat. And it's really nice, especially because you know all the people are wanting to breastfeed as well. So you talk to them and you go, oh my God, we're really struggling with sleep. But they're not just going to say, well, it's because you're breastfeeding. That's not going to happen. They're going to go, oh yeah, us too. Solidarity.
Yeah, and that's what you need, isn't it? Okay, so talk us through a bit kind of what to expect during the first week with breastfeeding.
Yeah, that first week is a tough one. And it's one that I say to parents that if you manage through that first week, that's the hardest bit. And you should absolutely congratulate yourself for that.
Yeah.
Because you have, like, that first day tends to be, the baby is very tired after birth, regardless of how you have given birth. They're going to be tired. They tend to be quite sleepy. They don't feed very frequently. We only expect a minimum of 4 feeds in that first 24 hours. So you kind of go, wow,
I've got an amazing baby.
They're just sleeping. This is brilliant. So much easier than I was told. Like, this is brilliant. And then it comes around to the second day and then the second night. And they call this second night syndrome. And the baby literally just wakes up and suddenly they feed. They are really fussy. They will not settle in their cot anymore. and you just can't do anything apart
yeah.
from them. And even sometimes feeding, it's not helping as well. And you just go, oh my God, what's happened to my baby?
Yeah.
Broken.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
that's so overwhelming. But knowing to expect that is a really key part of it. Knowing that it is going to come, it's normal. You're not doing anything wrong. Your baby's not broken. Maybe in the day leading up to it, getting sleep during the day. So if you have maybe just given birth and that second day tends to be a day where a lot of people want to come and see you, you know, family, mums and dads and all this people want to come and visit. So you have all these people around, you're shattered anyway, you get ready for bed and then this baby just will not sleep. So
Yeah.
maybe have that second day as a day that you just chill out, get some sleep during the day so that you are ready for the night rather than being overwhelmed, being overtired and not being able to cope during that point. That's like a big tip for that. Then it leads on to the next day, kind of the cluster feeding starts to build up a little bit because they are trying to get that milk to transition from that colostrum, which you'll have had from about 16 weeks pregnant. It comes in at that part, at that point, you do have that milk. And then it starts to transition to mature milk. So they're trying to do that cluster feeding to bring that change in. Again, it's like we've said, it's not that you've not got enough milk. It is just they're trying to change the milk. So that cluster feeding starts to begin. And it tends to come in commonly around day four, but it can be anywhere between day two and day six. Some people get it really early. Some people get it a little bit later. And it really, really varies, but most commonly around day four. And day four is one that if your milk does come in on that day, be prepared for, like we're saying, lots of emotions.
Cry. Yeah, that's the emotional day, isn't it?
It's a really big one. You just cry at everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything. Even if you don't feel like you're sad. It's a very big one.
I remember
and
that.
At that point, if your milk does start to transition, that's when your breasts fill up. They start to feel very engorged. And this can be quite difficult in terms of latching a baby as well, because it's like trying to latch onto a fully pumped up football. It's really difficult. So you need to try and soften the breast a little bit. So a little bit of massage and hand expressing before latching the baby will help to soften it a little bit to make them easily latch on rather than trying to latch onto a full breast. And you're literally like, it'll suddenly happen. You'll suddenly just balloon out. And I'm just in the shower just trying to put like warm water over my breast just to kind of naturally release a little bit of the milk rather than me full on expressing, because warmth does kind of trigger the movement of the milk. So that can be quite a full on day, that transition of between colostrum and mature milk. You've got the emotions, you've got your changes in your breast, and you've likely got a baby that's probably going to be still cluster feeding as well. So it is very overwhelming. So that first week is literally like every single day is a little bit different. And
I think as long as you're kind of aware of it, I think that helps, doesn't it? Like if you're prepared for what to expect, like you said, I think so many of us, we don't often actually think past the birth part, do we? So, you know, how much we think about that first week and feeding is, I guess, not a lot. So it's quite a shock. And we're kind of, from what we see on television and things like that, you know, we're led to believe breastfeeding is the easiest thing ever, you know, so natural, all of that. But actually it takes a lot of work. And it's quite shocking sometimes in the first week when, oh my goodness, they're feeding all the time. They're awake all night, you know. So knowing what to expect is half the battle, I'm sure.
I think it absolutely is. You know, if you can be aware that that is going to happen and that you probably are going to feel a little bit sad on that day and your breasts are going to balloon out and the baby's going to cluster feed and they're just going to feed consistently quite often, it does take away a lot of that worry. You go, okay, it's fine. This is normal. And you're not quite as overwhelmed. I mean, I certainly, that's from my experience from first time to second time, because first time, again, I did absolutely zero preparation in terms of breastfeeding. I just knew I wanted to breastfeed. That was it. That was all that my plan was. I was like, I'm going to breastfeed. That was it. So it was extremely overwhelming. Whereas second time around, I knew what to expect. I felt very prepared for it. And I literally just spent the first 2 weeks in bed, letting him feed and come off and on whenever he wanted. I co-slept with him. So we just slept whenever we needed to. And one, I let my body heal and recover. But also I built up that milk supply really, really quickly. And I can tell that personally from my own experience, but it's very different and it helps a lot. Because with my daughter, I didn't do that often feeding. I kind of tried to not feed her as frequently because I was like, oh no, this isn't normal, it's not okay. And I was trying to sort of settle her in other ways. And she ended up losing just over 9% of her birth weight.
Right, yeah.
It was fine. You know, we didn't need anything extra. But second time, when I was just literally letting him have unlimited access to the breast for the first like couple of weeks, he only lost 2% of his birth weight.
Yeah, which is amazing.
Huge difference. And I really felt that build in my milk supply from an early stage. And I felt like my milk supply and breastfeeding established a lot quicker second time. I find that is something really important as well. If you can put in that work and just be as responsive as you possibly can for those first couple of weeks, you reap the benefits of it a bit earlier. Whereas if you're trying to sort of fight against it, it actually ends up going on for a lot longer because that baby is still trying to build your milk supply. They're still trying to establish it. So actually you're kind of in that phase for a lot longer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The people that do just get that skin to skin contact, they let the baby come off and on the breast whenever they want, it does establish a lot faster. So
yeah, that's good advice.
It's honestly, and you should be anyway for the first
I know.
Week, honestly, I think we put so much pressure on ourselves as parents to just get back to normal. I love
and to look like we have it together.
Yes.
We need to look like we're coping.
Oh, God. I'm never coping. But I loved my postpartum period second time because I didn't put pressure on myself. I didn't plan to do stuff. I didn't have family round. We didn't do anything. I literally just spent the first 2 weeks in my pajamas in bed.
So nice.
I felt so much better. And I felt ready then after those 2 weeks. I was like, yeah, I've got this. I can do it.
That's so nice.
Ready to get up and take him on walks. And slings are the best things in the world, by the way, or get slim. But ready for that sort of thing rather than first time around. I was just so overwhelmed still. And we were still really muddling through it and figuring it out because I just fought against it so much. Whereas second time, I just accepted it, knew that was what it would be. And as soon as I surrendered to it, I was like, oh, I'm really relaxed now. I'm really calm.
Oh, nice.
Enjoying this.
Yeah.
Very, very different experience.
Yeah.
Personally.
No, that's good advice for people as well. And like we often say, like just those first kind of couple of weeks, we shouldn't be rushing around doing things. But I think it's so inbuilt, isn't it, to want to look like you're back to normal and you're out and about doing things. And it's a bit mad, really, but it's kind of just what we're like.
I was like, oh, I'm really enjoying spending some time in bed. And my mum went, oh, you should go out for a walk, go to a coffee shop. And I was like, I don't want to.
Yeah, you've got so long to do that. You don't need to do that in the first couple of weeks.
You've got to get out. I'm like, no, I don't. And I do not want to. I just want to stay in my bed.
It's funny, isn't it? It's funny how it's viewed, but kind of,
It's like you're not doing enough. Whereas you're doing exactly what your body needs it to do.
It's probably also viewed as if you're kind of, laying in bed all day, the view would be that you're not coping. Like, but actually, just because somebody puts on makeup and goes out, that's not a sign that they're coping. They're just probably trying to prove that they are to either themselves or other people. I mean, I definitely did that first time. Yeah. I wanted to look like I really had it all together and that, you know, I've just given birth and I was already like out. And
yeah,
I mean, who for? What is the point?
Yeah.
Stupid, really. So can we just talk a little bit just to finish on bottle feeding as well, and just talk a little bit about safe bottle prep. So
and that's something that I again think is really important because there are lots of different methods around, and actually very recently there's been more studies around with those methods. So formula needs to be made up with water that is above 70 degrees Celsius, and that is to kill the bacteria in the formula. So that bacteria, it's not bacteria that, you know, just makes babies a little bit poorly or is good for their immune system. Like a lot of people say, you know, bacteria is good. Yes, some bacteria, but this bacteria can cause sepsis and meningitis. So it's serious. It's not just a small, and it's not found frequently in formula, but they don't know when it is going to be found. So it is really, really important to make it up safely above 70 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
And there is a very well-known machine that I'm not going to name the name of, that basically makes it up in a way that it does a hot shot of water. You add the formula, mix it, and then it puts in cold water. And a recent study done by Amy Brown, who is absolutely amazing.
She's got a great book on breastfeeding as well, hasn't she?
Fantastic. They have discovered that 85% of the time, the water was not reaching 70 degrees Celsius. So that is a huge amount of the time that it wasn't making up the bottles and the formula safely.
Wow.
So yeah, I really, really do recommend staying clear of those. There are other things that you can use to help you make up bottles a little bit more easily, but in a safe way. You can get flasks that will obviously insulate the water, keep it nice and hot at the right temperature. Some people do it in two ways. They have one flask that is boiling water that's been cooled, and then one that is fully boiling water. You do need to make sure that the amount of boiling water is a decent amount. It can't just be a small amount because the temperature then drops very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So if it is that tiny little hot shot, the temperature drops very fast. So it has got to be a decent amount that actually the temperature will stay at 70
Yeah.
degrees. So you can use flasks. Some people, there is something, again, I'm trying not to name brands and stuff, but it basically a sort of device that rapidly cools down the formula instead. So you're still making it in that way with boiling water, but then it cools it down very quickly. And it tells you when it's at sort of a drinking temperature rather than you having to kind of like actively trying to cool it down.
Okay.
And you don't have to wait the full 30 minutes. I know when it says on the formula, it says, boil the kettle, wait 30 minutes, and then make the bottle. That's just not realistic.
It's not practical, is it?
So it's absolutely fine for you to boil the kettle and then immediately make the bottle.
Right,
That's
yeah.
No problem at all. You know, it's not an issue. You can sometimes get those kettles that actually have different temperatures on it. My parents have it specifically for like their tea. You
How
make
fancy.
it, which is, I know, it's like Ooling tea is made at 80 degrees apparently.
Oh, wow.
So maybe get one of those kettles.
I didn't know you could get those.
I know, it's amazing. And then you can sort of like make it at 80 degrees so that you know it's definitely hot, but maybe put it on that little bit higher so that it's hot enough. But then it won't take as long to maybe cool down afterwards. So it's that little bit quicker to make. But yeah, I really do recommend trying to stay away from those machines. If you do choose to have one of the machines, really make sure that the temperature is right, because this was by checking it. So 85% of the time it wasn't hot enough. So make sure that every time you do make it, you are checking the temperature so that it is absolutely hot enough rather than just trusting that it, because it's, you know, likely that it won't be making it hot enough. And again, if you do choose to use them, what I do suggest parents do is looking out for signs of reflux, colic, unsettled behaviour, because actually very, very commonly when these machines are used, these babies experience those kind of symptoms. And then they're put onto, you know, Gaviscon and all these different things to try and help it. But actually, a lot of the time, I suggest to just use the kettle for a few days and see what happens. And 9 times out of 10, those symptoms actually just go away completely. So just by the making of the bottles, it can impact, you know, the baby's behavior and how they're settled and things like reflux. So it is, yeah, it's just if you do decide to go with it and you're happy with the risk of it, you know, that's up to you. That is not anyone to judge at all, but it's just maybe being aware of those signs. And if they do come up, instead of going straight to things like medication, just trying out the kettle for a few days to see if that makes a difference. And if you have a premature baby, I would definitely suggest staying away from the machines because they are much more susceptible to, you know, infections and getting poorly because their immune system is that much lower.
Yeah.
So especially if you've got a premature baby. It's not something that people talk about very often, though, because you see on like Facebook groups all the time that, oh, I just make it up with, you know, I boil the kettle, I put the water in the bottles, and then I leave the bottles on the side and then add the formula. when ready for a feed, because they're thinking that the boiling of the kettle is to sterilize the water, but it's not. It's to sterilize the formula. And that's the important thing. It's making it up with the hot water, not because the water's a problem.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, and then you were going to talk about paste bottle feeding. I don't actually really know what that is, so enlighten me as well.
So paste bottle feeding, or some people call it responsive bottle feeding, it's literally just trying to move away from the typical sort of you lie a baby on their back and just have the bottle facing down, try and kind of get them to finish that bottle, have as much as possible so that they'll sleep a bit longer. We're trying to just be that little bit more responsive to baby. And this will likely mean that they feed a bit more frequently and smaller amounts. So the large amounts of formula or milk in any sort of form that are given, it's very common for people to say, oh, they end up having 8 ounce bottles. That's a huge amount. And it's
a lot.
Stretch their tummy. Whereas most babies, if we responsively feed them, they probably won't have any more than about 4 ounces. So it's just more about watching baby, being a bit more responsive to them. So instead of having them lying on the back, you sort of sitting them a bit more upright and having the bottle more horizontal. So
they need to work a bit harder as well for it. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it just gives them the control over the flow. So if the bottle is horizontal, it means that the end of the teat has got some milk in it, but it's not completely full.
Yeah.
And that means that when they have a little pause on the bottle, the milk flow slows as well, and it allows them to have that pause. Whereas if the bottle is just facing down, basically the baby can't take a pause because that milk will just keep flowing out, just because that's how bottles are. They just flow out consistently. So it is just basically allowing the baby to be able to have those pauses, like a baby does on the breast, like we do when we're eating. You know, we put our knife and fork down for a couple of seconds, we let our tummy settle, we check in with our brain, figure out, are we full or do we need a bit more? And we keep going if we're hungry. And that is exactly the same. We're just allowing them a few seconds. If they do pause, bring the bottle down a little bit. And when they initially go onto the bottle, having absolutely no milk in the end of the teat, just for a few sucks, because again, that's what they need to do on the breast. They don't immediately get that gratification.
Yeah.
So then bringing it up and then just taking regular breaks. If they don't take a regular break themselves and pause after about a minute or two, just bring the bottle down just for, again, 5-10 seconds. We're not saying take the bottle away from them, make them starve. It is just slowing it down a little bit, pacing it so that it gives them a bit of time to figure out when they are full and if they are still hungry. And like I said, the majority of the time, if we are pace feeding, responsive feeding, they probably won't have any more than about 4 ounces, and they will probably feed a little bit more frequently. And I know that sounds like an inconvenience. You know, we want them to feed more sort of, you know, that every 4 hours, that'd be great. Mm. It would be great. However, it is important for them and their bodies to be able to have that more frequent, smaller feeds. And that is normal. And it's really important to do that for sort of future mental health as well, because it can impact their relationship with food, basically.
Interesting,
because if we're sort of force feeding and trying to push them through those full cues, they get used to that, and then they get used to doing that later on in life. So later on, they will keep eating even though actually they are full. Teaching that from a really early age, just listen to their bodies, and we respect that. We go, you're pushing the bottle out, that means that you are full. We'll just go with that. And it's just being responsive. Some feeds may be bigger, some feeds may be smaller. And again, that's very similar to us as adults. Some days we'll have absolutely loads. Other points we'll just be like, oh, I'll just have a slice of toast for dinner, actually. Yeah. And I'm fine with that. So it's just that little bit more responsive and just slowing down that feed a little bit so that they have the control over the flow.
That's great. Yeah, that makes so much sense as well. Because the breasts, they were in control of it, aren't they?
Yeah.
So it would make sense with bottle feeding to give them that as well. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. You have been really insightful, very interesting. As I said, I've breastfed for many years and I've learned so much.
I love that. I'm constantly learning things about feeding.
Oh, yeah.
It always fascinates me.
It's amazing.
Like, wow. It's amazing.
I'm sure it'll be so helpful for people, particularly like first time, who really perhaps don't know what to expect at all or haven't decided maybe about what they want to do with feeding. Yeah. So really, really helpful. Where can people find you?
So I'm on Facebook and Instagram as Bees Birth and Boobs.
I love that name.
The alliteration. My husband came up with the name, so it's him.
Did he?
Thank for it. He's the one that figured it out.
That's great.
And my website is also Bees Birth and Boobs as well. So I do hypnobirthing courses in person. I do private courses. So if you're around the sort of Midlands area and are interested, get in touch. I also do breastfeeding support. I do preparing to breastfeed as well. So tailored to, personalized to people and what their needs are as well. And, the following weeks as well. I've got absolutely tons of content on my Instagram and Facebook as well. So again, even if you don't fancy booking in anything, just take a look on there, because there's loads of stuff. I'll try and make sure I've got plenty of information for people so that even if they don't want to spend the money,
it's there.
Resources.
That's one. I always say this, it's one great thing about the time we're living in. There's so much free information out there about everything. Like, there just wasn't, like, when my eldest is nearly seven, there's just when I was pregnant with her, there wasn't half of what there is now. So useful. But no, thank you. It's been really, really helpful. And I'll leave your details anyway in the show notes so that people can easily find you kind of learn a little bit more about what they need to do to prepare. But really, really useful. Thank you so much, Bee. And it was lovely to meet you as well.
Lovely being on here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Bye.